I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
In very recent news, an ancient piece of cloth has undergone what one might call significant scientific vindication. This piece of cloth has been the cause celeb of significant debate since it entered into the historical record way back in 1354. And now, despite a near full-on journalistic embargo, a new set of research and scientific data, at the very least, appear to codify it as being at least 2,000 years old, even if they're not so willingly wanting to acknowledge the claims underlying its whole nature of being, that it is possibly the very burial cloth of Jesus. And that, of course, tees up the launch for today's subject at hand, the New Testament textile, the sheet of Shekinah, the fine fibrous fabric of the fanatical Pharisee, the one, the only Shroud of Turin. And this is box number 7. In 1869, Mark Twain published what is considered the first true travel narrative directed at the world. It was titled The Innocents Abroad. Incidentally, my favorite book. This chronicled his 1867 exploits through Europe and the Holy Land, and even then, the subject of relics and souvenirs of pinnacle biblical/historical events was already being fatigued to its limits by the merchants, confidence men, and hucksters present on the streets. Twain humorously set up his skeptical view of relics and veneration by observing the Cathedral of St. Lorenzo in Genoa, and I quote Twain directly, quote, "The main point of interest about the cathedral is the little chapel of St. John the Baptist. They only allow women to enter it on one day in the year on account of the animosity they still cherish against the sex because of the murder of the saint to gratify a caprice of Herod. In this chapel, a marble chest in which they told us were the ashes of St. John. And around it was wound a chain, which they said had confined him when he was in prison. We did not desire to disbelieve these statements, and yet we could not feel certain they were correct, partly because we could have broken that chain, and so could St. John, and partly because we had seen St. John's ashes before in another church. We could not bring ourselves to think that St. John had two sets of ashes," unquote. Twain also noted how St. Helena, this would be Constantine's mother. By the way, you remember Constantine, right? The Byzantine ruler that assembled a modern morass of theologians to get under the hood and tinker around and ruin a good thing with all their tampering back in Nicaea, 325 AD. But anyway, his mother was St. Helena and apparently had a hankering for selling relics. In fact, as Twain notes in his book, she managed to set up shop right there in the Holy Land. And I quote him again, quote, "Then we went down to a cavern, which the cavaliers say was once a cistern. The chapel now, however, the chapel of St. Helena. It is 51 feet long by 43 wide. It is in it is a marble chair in which Helena used to sit while she superintended her workmen when they were digging and delving for the true cross. In this place, there is an altar dedicated to St. Demas, the penitent thief. That would be the, of course, thief on the cross. A new bronze statue is here, the statue of St. Helena. It reminded us of poor Maximilian, so stately shot. He presented it to this chapel when he was about to leave for his throne in Mexico. From the cistern, we descended 12 steps into a large, roughly shaped grotto carved wholly out of the living rock. Helena blasted it out when she was searching for the true cross. She had a laborious piece of work here, but it was richly rewarded. Out of this place, she got the crown of thorns, the nails of the cross, the true cross itself, and the cross of the penitent thief. When she thought she had found everything and was about to stop, she was told in a dream to continue a day longer. It was very fortunate. She did so and found the cross of the other thief. Unquote. And lastly, Twain's sarcasm wasn't reserved for just a particular. He also noticed a general sense of guile during that time period. Quote, "But isn't this relic matter a little overdone? We find a piece of the true cross in every old church we go into, and some of the nails that held it together. I would not like to be positive, but I think we have seen as much of a keg of these nails. Then there is the crown of thorns. They have part of one in Sainte-Chapelle in Paris and part of also one in Notre Dame. And as for the bones of St. Denis, I feel certain we have seen enough of them to duplicate him, if necessary." Unquote. And so it goes without saying that 157 years have passed since the greatest American scribe wrote those words and chronicled the absolute viral saturation of identity relics. So it goes without saying that the Shroud of Turin has had a lot of time to be a mendacious mirage of meticulous manufacturing. I'll bet that Council of Nicaea had a ton of merch booths outside as the cognoscenti, the brain trust inside, sat around and hammered out a set of proclamations that pounded the Godhead into nearly an unrecognizable morass of confusion. Yes, I said that. Fight me on it. Hey, where's my egg shaker?
Little one for the collectors here. Oh, my, my. Summertime's here, babe. I got something that's pretty cool. Well, that summertime's here, babe, and I ain't gonna make no fool. I got me some Byzantine swag, and I'm gonna sell it to you. Just listen right here, 'cause I'm your Nicene man. Don't stop me unless you're gonna buy. My, my, I'm your Nicene man. There's nothing I can't get you, guy. 'Cause all my connections, they know where all the relics lie. I'll tell you how it is right now. I'm usually passing by, selling stuff from dawn to dusk, including elephant tusk. Well, I'm usually passing by, don't mean to be so brusque. I could pay all my bills if I could just find Moses Husk. Oh yeah, I got a pillar of salt, a soldier's spear, that sword that hacked off a centurion's ear. But I'm your Nicene man, stop me if you wanna buy. 'Cause all my relics, they're guaranteed to satisfy. Take it away, boys, play me something here. We'll be right back. Nicene man. I'm your Nicene man. I'm your Nicene man. 'Cause all my relics are guaranteed to satisfy.
All right, listen up, and before anybody says that I'm being sacrilegious here, understand something. I'm talking about relics. I am talking about objects. I am not talking about the venerable individual behind them that is the cause for all of this intrigue. That doesn't mean I don't think this stuff is cool. So, and despite my completely satirical take on the nature of relics and the merchandising scenarios behind them, I am not yet ready to dismiss out of hand the possibility that God also has also meant for physical evidence to exist, to point to his sacrifice and atonement for those on the cusp of unbelief. And while Christ did say, "Blessed are those who have not seen and believed," he still manages to leave room for the skeptic to come falling in the doorways of faith by avenues slightly more empirical. So I'm just going to say at the outset, I have no horse in the shroud game. My faith in the death, burial, and subsequent resurrection of Christ are independent of any conclusion regarding what is essentially a relic. And relics are a definitive part of the liturgical denominations, especially since they place an unusual amount of veneration upon them. In this case, the Catholic Church. Again, I seem to mention them more often than not here. The chain of custody for this object only lasts about 670 years, leaving another 1,330 years of quote-unquote blank tape, to quote the Nixonian era of the providential, although in another example proving that corruption and implicit bias isn't just a hallmark of 1974, we could include the 16th of cocaine found in the current White House. So at the very least, the chronologically accurate assessment of its age would at least make further debate a lot more comfortable if it can be established to be from timeframes between 0 and 30 AD. And if that's the case, we might have a legitimate conversation here. But at the end of the day, if it's real, amazing. If it's a hack forgery, some second-string Caravaggio using a dilute iron ochre tempera paint, well, again, to quote Tommy Lee Jones's character from The Fugitive, as he's getting ready to honor the charge of his badge, which was to arrest a man who absolutely proclaims his innocence, "I don't care." All right, that's not true. I care. I care because life would be so boring without things like this. All right, the Shroud of Turin is a 14-foot linen cloth with the image of a crucified man that has long and a controversial history behind it. In short, to anyone wondering what it is if you've never heard of it or seen it, the claim is essentially thus. A crucified Jesus was removed from the cross. As per the Roman protocols, his face was wrapped in a small linen to prevent unsightly drainages from the mouth and nose. A larger set of linen was employed to cover the rest of the body. The essential claim is that the supernatural moment of the resurrection was so intense, something so cataclysmically connected to the light of the world, that a literal photographic imprint was transferred to the textile that bears no photographic properties and only achievable by an intensity of light and purpose that can only be a forensic record of the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In fact, recent developments make substantial claims that all three are represented on the linen. We will try to cover those shortly. These are admittedly extraordinary claims, and really only through the known scientific processes, developments, and breakthroughs that any claims can either be supported or dismissed. 1988 was the most high profile of dismissals, however, as carbon dating would substantiate the shroud as a 14th century hoax, or at any rate, inauthentic. I will be referencing in a deferential sense the work of Dr. Robert Spitzer. I believe you could refer to him as Father Robert Spitzer, a Catholic priest as well, but also one of the most principled defenders of the Shroud, one of the most energetic advocates for its authenticity, and quite frankly, a joy to listen to because of his enthusiasm, even if you do or don't believe. And like I said, I'm not sure where I come down on anything like this, but it really isn't about me. I'm just going to present what I found to be interesting. First of all, let's define things. As I said, a 14-foot linen cloth. This was presumably wrapped by Joseph of Arimathea. It is a complex weave from Middle East antiquity. It does contain human blood with hemoglobin and even a partial DNA profile. The blood type is AB positive. This blood has a perfect correspondence to the biblical account of the crucifixion. The blood contains ferritin-creatine mixture, two enzymes that fuse together and synthesize when someone experiences what is called a polytrauma, which we could all argue through all known accounts of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. A polytrauma is just the basic description of what happened. The blood also has what is called a serum plasma ratio, indicating that the body was maintained in a vertical position for a sustained period of time, predominantly through the polytrauma period. It is the most scientifically analyzed relic in the world and has supposedly been through 123 different tests as tests have been able to be applied. It is considered a three-dimensional capture as there are identifiable subdermal contusions in the image. It is essentially a photographic negative of a non-photosensitive cloth and the only one. It would require supposedly 6 to 8 billion watts of light to reproduce as a photographic negative on a non-photographic linen, and furthermore, from every place on the figure's body. Research shows that the blood was on the shroud before the image was placing chronology of the resurrection into view, and it also means that no contracted image could have been accurately created around the arbitrarily placed blood spots. So in 1978, scientists start by proclaiming its validity from a thermochemical point of view, at least. That was all they had. And then it was 1988, the crux of nearly 100% of the controversy, or in some people's minds, the lack of controversy. But it was the first allegedly exhausted carbon dating analysis was undertaken. The protocol stated that 7 different samples from various parts of the shroud were to be analyzed. These 7 samples were to be given independent blind analysis from 7 different labs. One account I read said that 7 samples were actually removed in 1978 and placed aside as a precursor to the known and ongoing developments in carbon dating, knowing that eventually the carbon dating would be able to be undertaken. By the time the high-profile scientific proclamation in 88 happened, one that stated that the shroud was indeed a 15th-century creation was made, the protocols of 7 had been reduced to 3. All 3 laboratories detected cotton samples in their studies, something that was not existent in Jerusalem in the first century. This resulting trifecta of results destroyed the shroud's value as a relic, as an icon, and certainly as a visual and tactile inroad to belief by anyone in doubt of the gospel story. However, between you and me, That might have been the point. It would later be discovered that all three labs tested the same sample, the same single sample that was broken into three pieces. And that sample was the post-fire repairs in the 15th century, and that was repaired with cotton-based gum-dyed grafts that was placed by nuns who attempted to repair the periphery of the burned shroud. So the only summation about the shroud in 1988 came from compromised samples with known repair providence in the 15th century. Why these allegedly non-biased labs came to evaluate tainted evidence is only up to supposition. Yeah, right. But it certainly feels like someone wanted to put their thumb on the scale, for sure, although there is no proof. In 1998, thermochemist Dr. Ray Rogers invalidated the samples when he discovered the issue. The British Museum, who held the original carbon dating data, ultimately released it years later after severe cajoling through Freedom of Information requests. The dating showed stratification between old and new fibers in the same sample, thus showing the lines of repair had specific and clear lines of demarcation. So the 1988 process, say what you will about the shroud, in and of itself was bogus. Since that time, the shroud has been put through four primary tests, quoting an article by Dr. Spitzer. One is called the Vanillin test. Rogers developed something called the Vanillin test to measure the age of cellulose in ancient fabrics. Something called linogen or linogen cellulose can be converted to vanillin, not a process, by the way, that I can actually say I understand, but an organic compound that decays with age. And by measuring the percentage of the vanillin in cellulose fibers in various materials of ancient origin, the age of fabrics within a defined range of error, plus or minus, can be reasonably estimated. Rogers performed these vanillin tests on several ancient fabrics and then compared them to the shroud. He concluded that the 1988 carbon-14 test was not consistent with the vanillin test. Number two was Giuello Fanti's Fourier transformed infrared spectroscopy test of cellulose degradation. Then there was the Raman spectroscopy laser testing of cellulose degradation. So we have two cellulose degradation tests, one with infrared, one with laser, and then ultimately a mechanical test of compressibility and breaking strength of fiber tests. Those four tests conducted. So without going through all those processes, as I describe them, they sort of self-explanatory, at least in a cursory sense. The averages of these four processes apparently place the shroud somewhere near 50 AD with a plus or minus ratio of 150 years either way, with a 95% confidence level. So that's the whole crazy, meticulous, scientific gobbledygook end of it, which sounds pretty cool, but when simplified to an understandable degree, at least tends to put the shroud back within the time frame where it could legitimately be placed at the time of Jesus' crucifixion. But then we have external evidence, which to me is even more interesting. So you have it has to do with pollen fossils located in the fabric. So the preponderance of pollen fossils in the shroud have their greatest concentration in Jerusalem and then surrounding Judea. Then the pollen fossils taper off in order of the shroud's known travel routes from there. So pollen found on the shroud's fibers matches pollen found in Jerusalem, according to Avinoam Denine's 1999 book titled Flora and the Shroud of Turin. However, floristics, the study of flora like this, is fascinating in a result, but like the larger discipline of botany, is so boring. Me, I'd rather talk about coin collecting. Oh, wait, coincidentally, we have more interesting shroud-tastic news. And that would happen to deal with coins, coincidentally. So Roman leptons. The Roman coins of the day were known as the lepton, and if you look at the shroud and study the shroud data, you will see there were Roman leptons on the eyes of the figure portrayed on the shroud. It is also known to be a standard practice to reduce the macabre nature of death by placing coins on the eyes in the event that the eyes of the executed man were to come open. This was to act as a counterweight and keep them closed, and also a sign of respect for family members who were going to be encountering their dead loved one in a face-up position. The shroud contains images of two Roman leptons sitting on the eyes of the figure galvanized into the shroud. These coins also contained four anomalies or enigmas that cannot be matched with any other coins in the numismatic literature. Numismatic, by the way, is the fancy word for coin-related or coin-collecting. So they can't be matched to anything in the coin-collecting, coin-cataloging literature. Oh, with one exception. There was a singular minting in Jerusalem, 29 AD, by none other than, well, this obscure guy whose name you probably never heard. Pontius Pilate. Okay, not so obscure. And if you have at least 10 seconds of Sunday school history or one-off felt board hermeneutics or ever heard the song Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones, then you know who Pontius Pilate is. And quite frankly, if Mick Jagger knows more about the crucifixion than you do, you may need to reevaluate a few things. Although, the crucifixion story also includes Jesus dying for Mick Jagger too, so take my joke as it is, an attempt at comparative irony and nothing else. Anyway, if the discussion of numismatic details isn't your cup of tea, we have yet another amazing wrinkle in the saga of the shroud. Ladies and gentlemen, pinch-hitting in the top of the ninth with liturgical bases loaded, in the hopes of a walk-off grand slam, approaching home base with bat in hand is none other than another shroud. Okay, maybe not exactly, but just a smaller shroud of completely separate provenance, but more than plausible connection to this shroud. I just wanted to do that because of my weird PhD in the historical, satirical underpinnings of one Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Go and tell your master that we have been charged by God with a sacred quest. If he will give us food and shelter for the night, he can join us in our quest for the Holy Grail.
Well, I'll ask him, but I don't think he'll be very keen. He's already got one, you see.
What?
He says they've already got one.
Are you sure he's got one?
Oh, yes, it's very nice, sir.
I told him we already got one.
One of the things I have always found dubious about the shroud and the fact that it hails as a singular sample of Sanhedrin sedition is the fact that it appeared to conflict with the biblical account of Peter noticing that the cloth had been wrapped around Jesus' head in John chapter 20. What happened to that thing? Well, it seems there is one out there, and I didn't know about this. And yes, I will grant the skeptic their immediate observation that no counterfeiter of any skill would be so stupid as to omit this from the replication task list. I mean, if you can't read the Bible before cranking out a faux burial cloth, what good are you? Really? Seriously. However, this little cloth bears some amazing, amazing characteristics. It is known as the Sudarium of Oviedo, or otherwise known as the face cloth of Oviedo. Oviedo, of course, being the place where it is currently housed. As we say, the Shroud of Turin is in Turin, and the face cloth of Oviedo is in Oviedo. The chain of custody itself goes back to 616 AD, even before testing comes into the mix, which also places an untested shroud there too for reasons that will be stated here. It remains in Oviedo, Spain to this day with its own displays of veneration. The face cloth contains 120 to 124 bloodstains that, when taken into semi-opacity as an image, perfectly matches the 124 bloodstains on the face of the shroud when overlaid directly. This includes the top of the head, the back of the head, and all the way to the nape of the neck. This also includes liquid perfusions, spittle on the side of the mouth, and the pleural edema fluid leaking out of the nose. All of it identical in overlay. The face cloth contains no facial image for referential counterfeiting. In other words, they were both present at the same moment, the same sanguine moment. They touch the same face at the same time. In the same moment, or at least reasonably close, during wound leakage. So the protocol would have worked like this. An expired body on the cross would be subject to the macabre levels of gravity. The jaw would be loose and multiple liquid perfusions would be pouring out of the cranial orifices. The head wrap is used to solidify and cover the more astonishingly harsh aspects of death while the body is being moved. Once in the tomb, the head wrap would be removed. This explains the last imagery and only bloodstains. But the other protocols, such as a thorough cleaning of the body, one that would have deprived a shroud of the finite details, was not undertaken, most likely to accommodate the rush to complete the burial by Passover, which was near, and all measures had to be complete before sundown. So the shroud and its resulting imagery is basically benefiting by a rush job. In 1354, by the way, so a timeline for the shroud, 1354, the earliest historical records of the Shroud of Turin place it in Lirey, France, during the 1350s. A French knight named Geoffrey de Charny allegedly presented it to the dean of the church in Lirey as Jesus' authentic burial shroud. There's no record of how Charny got his hands on the shroud, nor where it was during the 1300 intervening years since Christ's burial outside Jerusalem, although it is believed that the knight had a friend that stole it and basically didn't want to squeal or dry snitch on his homies. 1389, the Bishop of Troyes, Pierre d'Arcy, claims the shroud is a forgery. In 1453, Geoffrey de Charny's granddaughter gives the shroud to the House of Savoy. 1532, the shroud is damaged by fire and water in Chambéry, where it was kept by the House of Savoy, and 15th century nuns, rushing to its defense, repair the damages with cotton fibers. This would prove to be one of the significant and determining factors and ultimately disqualifying factors for the 1988 carbon dating analysis. In 1578, the shroud is moved to Turin, the new capital in the House of Savoy. In 1683, the shroud is placed in the Chapel of the Holy Shroud, designated by the architect Guarini. And in 1983, the Catholic Church takes ownership of the shroud after the death of Umberto II. So in 1997, another fire breaks out in Turin Cathedral, but the firefighters managed to save the shroud where it was not affected. And it remains in Turin to this day. The shroud is rarely exhibited to the public, and when it is, it's kept in an airtight, climate-controlled case. Some believe the shroud is the burial shroud of Jesus, of course, while others think it's simply a religious icon that indirectly reflects the story of the resurrection. As for me and my house, we don't care. Okay, again, we care, and I think it's pretty cool and hope it at least gives one pause to think. We could be literally looking at a snapshot in time. And somehow the idea that the Lord of Glory may have galvanized himself into the upper fibers, and by the way, it is only on the upper fibers that this can be found, is an interesting thing and a pretty cool idea. It is not known to be achievable by natural photographic means and available to us, and it means that we are potentially looking at the past technologically provided by the future of a God who is eternally present. Hey, take it for what it's worth. Most importantly, the shroud, and by extension, the tomb, is empty. And that is what really is important. And this is box number 7.
Thank you.